Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, the Free Markets series, where this week we're going to take a look at the emerging economies of the world. If anyone has been profoundly instrumental in bringing together those economies and the principles of a sound economy and free markets, it's our guest, Michael Fairbanks, who this year is teaching at Harvard, but who has done great work in practically every region of the globe. And in some cases, I'll give you just one example, they're quite grateful, so grateful, in fact, that one day the president of strife-torn Rwanda leaned towards him across a table and slipped him something. It was a passport. He said, Michael, I'm making you a citizen of this country. Here's Michael Fairbanks. Michael Fairbanks, here's a remarkable quote, and it's from you. I can predict the future of a developing nation better than any IMF team of economists by asking one question. Do you believe in competition? Now, when I go to Venezuela and I say, do you believe in competition? They say, competition means the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. They say, competition is the unnecessary duplication of effort to get two firms doing the same thing. But I go to Silicon Valley and I say, what do you think about competition? And they say, I love competition because even when I lose, I learn something. So this is sort of the free market message applied to poorer countries in a way, isn't it?
Absolutely. When an IMF team goes into a country, they're trying to project exports and imports, they're trying to value the currency, they're looking at policies. All that is great, but in most ways it's an outcome of the way a nation already thinks. So the most important thing is to look at values, attitudes, beliefs, assumptions about the universe, attributions to other. If you can understand a nation's culture, then you can understand their policies and their strategies and the outcome of that culture. So I ask two or three questions. Do you believe in competition as a force for positive change? Or do you think it's the unnecessary duplication of effort? I also say, do you think about the future more than the past? Or do you revere the past so much that it prevents you from thinking about the future? I also ask, do you believe in complexity? Do you believe that there are feedback loops and systems effects and determinants that unwind themselves over time? Because people who believe in competition are confident about the future, obsessed with the future, and think that they need to comprehend complexity are the people who are most likely going to be prosperous in such a complicated and challenging world.
Now you're starting from really low down the mountain, of course, in these countries, because the exact opposite applies. They have these systems that usually benefit the few by hereditary title or just by sheer, you know, dictatorial power. And you want to come in there and sort of create a ferment. You've had a great relationship with the president of Rwanda, Kagame, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But he's the exception. What would you do with Chavez? I mean, has Chavez ever talked to you?
I've worked for two presidents of Venezuela, but when Hugo Chavez took power, he wasn't interested in proceeding with this anymore. Well, the other thing that you find, the difference between a poor country and a rich country, is a poor country thinks that wealth is subsoil assets, you know, bauxite and copper. They think it's sunshine. They think it's abundance of cheap labor. And they think it's location. If you have a good location to a big market, then you must be rich. So Venezuela has all of those traits.
Right.
It has oil, it has proximity to the United States market, it has lots of poor people to employ in the oil fields and the bauxite mines, and it has plenty of sunshine. But in reality, if you compete on these basic factors, you're competing on the most easily imitated advantage a nation possesses. You know why? Because Venezuela has oil, but so does Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? The sunshine in Venezuela is exactly the same sunshine in Colombia. And the poor people in Venezuela are the same as the poor people in the north of Brazil. So when you have an advantage that's easily imitated by another nation, you compete only on the dimension of price when you export a product.
Mm-hmm.
If you compete on price, that means you have to keep your costs low in order to export. Well, you can't manage your extraction costs very much more. And you can't devalue the currency without creating more and more poverty. So what you end up doing is keeping labor wages very, very low, which means the harder you work, the poorer you get. Which means the only competition you're in is to see which nation can stay the poorest the longest until its society disintegrates. And that's really the definition of a poor country. Or if I could use the unprogressive term, people will hold this against me, we're not supposed to say this anymore, the third world. That's the third world. But if you believe that wealth is insight, systems thinking, knowledge, if you believe that wealth can be shot off a satellite dish or through a phone line, or someone with great skills and abilities can buy an airplane ticket and go somewhere else in the world, if you believe wealth is those higher ordered advantages, then that's a country that's bound to be prosperous.
But you need an open door. Come back to Kagame in Rwanda. You obviously convinced him early on to give you free rein. He set his conditions. He said you'd have to reimburse your salary.
Oh my gosh.
If you didn't get a result.
Wow. I do lots of interviews. No one's ever been this prepared before. That's right. First of all, trying to convince Paul Kagame in high-ordered strategic advantages pushing in on an open door. That's all how he already thinks.
Mm-hmm.
There was no convincing to be made.
So, but that's a lucky exception, I would gather.
It's a lucky exception to work with such a man because he understands the principles of competitive strategy naturally and because he was a military commander fighting against great odds to end the genocide. So he understood all this stuff. In the end, I think I put his vision into practice. I didn't have to give him this vision. He understood it. Maybe to a certain extent I helped him with some vocabulary, some language, some tools and things. But this is how he already thought. And that's what makes Rwanda so exceptional to this day.
And he gave you citizenship.
He did. And it's the honor of my life. Because, about 5 or 6 years ago, he just said to me one day when we were talking, you should be a Rwandan citizen. And I said, oh my gosh, what a great thing. And a few months later in a subsequent meeting, I went into a little room and he just sort of pushed the passport across the table.
Oh, really?
Said, if you pick this up, you're Rwandan. And I picked it up.
Wow, and you carry it with you? Or?
I do. I have it here today.
But do you travel as an American or as a Rwandan?
When I'm in Europe or Africa, I'm African. When I re-enter North America, I have to use the U.S. passport, which I'm also proud of.
And you, for instance, took the gorillas, and I don't mean the gorilla fighters, I mean the gorillas, the primates.
Right.
You took the primates, the big gorillas of the Rwandan jungle, and you turned that into something of value for the... Let's talk about that, because that's very concrete, and it's a good move.
Yeah.
What did you do?
Well, it's actually a great case study, because when I first went to Rwanda 12 years ago, and I worked in tourism all over the world, in Colombia and Bermuda and Afghanistan and all these places. So here we are in Rwanda, and the Rwandan tourism sector is telling me, we need lots of tourists now. People are afraid of Rwanda because of the genocide, but we need millions of tourists. I say, no, you don't need millions of tourists. You need very, very few tourists who are willing to spend a lot of money and stay a long period of time. That's how tourism works. It's called the tourism yield.
Mm-hmm.
How few tourists can you get to spend a lot of money per day and just stay for 2 or 3 weeks? So I said to the Rwandans, we don't want backpacker tourism. We want very well-to-do people. I'm sorry if this sounds undemocratic, but we're trying to run a business here for them. We want very well-heeled people to come here and have a unique experience on the planet Earth. Because they're not saying, let's see the gorillas in Rwanda or the gorillas in Uganda. They're saying, should we go to Rwanda and see the gorillas, or should we go to Angkor Wat in Cambodia?
Yeah.
Or should we go to the Galapagos, or should we go to Machu Picchu? Those people with choices are the ones we wanted. Well, the tourism sector was up in arms. They wanted me fired. They wanted me pushed away because all they wanted was numbers of tourists. I said, no. If we're pushing luggage around for a tourist who comes here and spends $50 a day, we're going to destroy the pristine environment that the gorillas live in. We're going to destroy the roads. Our hotels can't handle that kind of size of the market, and we won't satisfy those people. We want very, very few tourists. So I was explaining this at a tourism conference in Uganda, and a Kenyan woman stood up and she said, "My Rwandan brothers and sisters, listen to this man, because we went the way you want to go and we've destroyed tourism in Kenya. Hmm. He's telling you the way to do it and this is correct." Well, it didn't matter what the tourism sector wanted back then, because I did have the support of one person.
The president.
And that was President Paul Kagame, who said, "Let's do it this way because the rest of Africa has done it the other way." And tourism revenues have exceeded our projections every single year. It's now a unique product offering on the planet Earth. Hmm. And this June, we raised the price to enter the national park from $35 a person in 2000 when we started this to $750 per person just to get into the park. Now what we've done is we spread those profits to the surrounding villages, and the people are benefiting from this and they're protecting the gorillas. And when the tourists show up, they wave and they're happy and they work hard as guides.
And stop the poaching, I guess.
The poaching. There hasn't been a killed gorilla in Rwanda in 7 or 8 years.
And you've applied this elsewhere. I think I read in the research in Arequipa, Peru, you had spotted a hotel that was doing everything wrong.
Yeah, boy, you're really scaring me. Arequipa is the real business center, the traditional business center of Peru. And I had this discussion with President Alberto Fujimori in the early 90s, where he announced on TV one night that he wanted 1 million new tourists to come to Peru the following year. And I called the president and I said, "Mr. President, please don't say that. You don't want 1 million new tourists next year." He said, "What do I want?" I said, "You want one tourist next year. You want it to be Bill Gates, and you want him to give you $50 million for a unique experience that only we can provide him in Peru." And he said, "That's absurd." And I said, "But that's the illustration I want in your head. Very, very few tourists who will not destroy the pristine environment around Machu Picchu, that will not destroy the Colca Valley of Peru, which is, after the Grand Canyon, the second greatest canyon in all of the Western Hemisphere. We want fewer and fewer tourists who are having a unique experience that they want to pay more money for. Then we take the surplus from that and we give it to the guides who speak languages, the chefs who prepare world-class food, the logistics and transportation people who have fantastic buses and automobiles, and everybody makes a profit. If we try to attract millions of tourists, we destroy the environment. We use people who just carry luggage for us.
Same ideas in Rwanda.
Absolutely.
But did Gates come?
Gates has been to Peru, and he's been to Rwanda to see the gorillas.
So he's listening to you.
So I don't think Gates listens to anybody but Buffett. But he certainly was an illustration that proved to be true.
And you also say that, is it Howard Schultz, the head of Starbucks?
Do yeah. I have a
first name right?
Yes.
So Mr. Schultz of Starbucks has done more for the coffee growers of the third world or emerging world than they could have done without him.
The private sector people who've come in and bought Rwandan products and put people to work have created a tax base, they've created self-esteem and identity, they've created exports that brings in hard currency, they've done more than so much of the foreign aid, so much of the grants, so much of the sanctimony and condescension that comes with a lot of foreign aid, not all foreign aid, but with a lot of foreign aid. But I'll say something that's even more aggressive than about Howard and Starbucks in Africa. The Chinese have done more to eradicate poverty in Africa than all of the foreign aid in history. Hmm. And they've done this in ways that people don't understand. People think the Chinese are coming into Africa and working with corrupt systems.
And convict labor from
convict
China.
Labor, extracting the raw materials, polluting the environment, creating...
Isn't that a bit true?
There are incidents of it that a receptive Western media amplifies through the echo chamber. Mm-hmm. But in reality, if you look at the real research from the African Development Bank, from the scholars like Deborah Brodigan at American University in Washington, you find out that these incidents aren't any more than what the West has done to Africa, and they're not any more than what the Chinese do to their own people in China. Mm-hmm. In other words, there's room for improvement. We need to get better at it. But there's not this condescending top-down immoral activity. The Chinese simply want to do business with Africa because Africa could be a breadbasket for China. China needs to grow at 9% a year in order to keep peace. The only way to do that is to have some raw materials from Africa and some markets in Africa, and to also take the surplus of males that are in exist in China and send them to Africa as laborers. There's about 500,000 Chinese in Africa right now. So it's a lot more complex than people think.
But it's based on real economic activity. You don't believe in what you call the charity trap.
Correct. And neither do the Chinese. The Chinese do the same things in Africa they do in China. You can argue if that's good or bad or how much better they need to do. But they certainly don't condescend to the Africans. And Africans appreciate that. Africans will tell you privately that they don't like doing business with the West because we insist on exporting our values before we do the deal, and the deal is always based on charity. The Chinese don't need to export their values to do business with them. They don't care about the Africans. They're not over there trying to eradicate poverty. It's not a mission of theirs. But they're also extremely transparent about what they want. We want your oil. We want to send our products to your market. And in return, we're not going to interfere with the sovereign issues of your country. And you know why? Because we don't want anybody interfering in the sovereign issues of our country,
and
like
we'll
Taiwan
build,
and Tibet.
And we'll build you some roads.
We'll build you some roads and some soccer stadiums. We will build your Ministry of Foreign Affairs building for you. And in return, we would like to set up a special economic zone. We'd like to take some raw materials, make something out of it, re-export it to somewhere else in the world.
But we could smarten up, because we could build roads. We could do a lot of what you're describing.
That's the thing. The Chinese are beating us in the developing world at the game we invented. Mm-hmm. If we decided to go in there with real business interests, build factories, build research and development capacity, help small businesses, that's what we're really good at. But our relationship to poor people is based on condescension and charity instead of what built our own country. And the Chinese, having learned pragmatism from us, which is an American word, a word developed on the campus of Harvard by Charles Sanders Peirce, the Chinese are the pragmatists, and we're the ideologues.
And what would allow for Paul Kagame, I mean, he is an exception, as we've said, for more of those leaders, because there's more Chavez than Kagame in the emerging world. How could we encourage that? Is there any way to encourage that, or does it have to spring from inside?
I'm so glad you're the interviewer, because these are just the best questions. When America went into Afghanistan and we put Karzai in charge of Kabul, he didn't become the president of Afghanistan. He didn't even become the president of Kabul. He became the president of his house. Nobody outside his house is respecting him, because he was installed as an American restaurateur. He was installed in Afghanistan. Now, one of the benefits of the genocide, which is a weird thing to say, is that when the French turned and went away and the Americans never showed up to help, despite knowing about the genocide 8 weeks in advance, which most people don't know about, that gave the Rwandans the opportunity to grow their leadership organically, indigenously, independently. So Paul Kagame is a leader that wasn't installed by a foreign power. He was a guy that grew up in a refugee camp. He was a guy that came up through the Ugandan military, educated by the Cubans and the Americans, the only leader in the world educated by both those groups.
Yeah, that's funny, man.
And he ended up having the moral authority to get some things done because the people put him in power, not any foreign power. And that's really fundamental to our understanding, which is, you know, as things break down in Libya and they will in Syria, as things fall apart in Afghanistan, we need to learn that we need to find the people there that are the future stars, the people that the indigenous population wants to put in power, and just help that person. Find the great people and give them rocket fuel. Don't pick them ourselves because they talk like us, they look like us, they went to our school and put them into power. That's a big lesson that we haven't learned yet.
It's hard to do, though, because you know, there may be some of these leaders may be young men, and then they grow into tyrants.
It's true. Seen it all the time in Africa. They come back from Europe in the 60s and 70s with PhDs, very sophisticated thinkers. Look at Mugabe in Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm,
in
yeah.
the 80s, he was a freedom fighter. In the 90s, he was a hero to the nation. And now he's a really terrible, terrible leader.
Yeah.
And that's an example of what could go wrong.
And it all points to what one could call free markets.
Mm-hmm.
It's just simple economic
right.
activity will do more than grandiose projects, even building a dam or whatever, with foreign money.
I think it's true. I think if we really wanted to help the poorest countries in the world, our country would find a way to use our competitive advantage, which is the private sector. It's the thing that we do better than anyone else. We have the best brands. We have the best business schools. We have the most sophisticated capital markets. If our country wanted to really help the poorest people in the world, we would find a way to incent that group of people to go to these places. But we don't do that.
And where did you find the confidence? You seem to address these presidents, you know, Fujimori and Kagame. Most people would be a little bit intimidated, but you get their ear and then you give them the advice.
I think I'm always intimidated. Sometimes President Kagame calls my house, and my wife can always tell when he's on the phone because I'm standing up. I get the phone, I just pick it up like it's anybody, and I hear the words, "State House Kigali, please stand by for the president," and I stand up because he's the president of a country. I've known him for 12 years. I call him Mr. President. With great respect, with awe for everything that he's achieved. I wouldn't dare call him in a personal or a friendly way, even though I feel friendly with him. He's the president of a sovereign state that's overcome amazing things using strategy, private sector principles, very much oriented towards the market. And when he calls or someone else calls the house, I stand up. I'm still nervous, you know.
Well, Michael Fairbanks says, the title of one of your books says, "You plow the water and something grew."
Yeah.
Thank you and long life.
Thank you very much.
Michael Fairbanks. And now, here's something else coming up on The World Show.
Communications is really the solution to everything. The best communication will save lives. It will create faster action because these people can communicate. And it needs to be reliable communication. Communication is the key to everything, in fact. We know from 9/11 in New York
yeah.
that communication really failed.
And
not just the communication from the tower that fell down,
sure.
but rather the communication between different devices completely failed.
Between the fire department and the police
exactly.
department, yes, that's notorious.
Exactly. Yeah. So communications in every disaster is the most important thing. The reliability of the communication is second to none.
The dangers, okay, it can occur anywhere in the research process. Where you see it most often is after drugs are approved, and it's the most costly. Vioxx is a great example of that. Vioxx was pulled from the market after all the money was spent on getting it to market, and
mm-hmm.
that to me is the most costly. I think that pharma in general rushes these things through. I think it's a time constraint of the researchers themselves. And when you constrain the time that it takes to do things properly at the grassroots level, what you're going to cut are all the safety and ethical steps.
In spite of all the trash and frustration on what happened on Wall Street and elsewhere and other markets, it seems that the memory of the public is very short. And I think we're getting back quickly to the old habits in terms of, you know, compensation being very high for not taking much risk, seeing situation of conflict of interest and so on. So, you know, it's human nature. At its best, and
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, our we have the best system in the world. Capitalism works well, but there's only capitalists who can kill capitalism. And if you let capitalist bring it to its limit. You risk, you run the risk of killing the system. So that's where regulation comes from, and you need to put some limitations. And remember, in the old days, when you had the investment banks that were separate from the lending banks, that were separate from other financial sectors, we've all put that together around the world, and that leads to conflict.
Michael Fairbanks was our guest this week on the Free Markets series of the World Show. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.